Absolutely, a real science show for you tonight. But I'm going to take the first 10 minutes or so to talk with Sir Charles Schulz, because he looks at Mars artifacts as well, get his reaction to that Spirit Rover photograph that's up there at the coasttocoastam.com website. Also, two videos that Sir Charles has given us. You'll find that there at coasttocoastam.com as well. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP test software for the Pershing 2 missile system, worked on Patriot and Copperhead tank killer and advanced attack helicopter systems as well. Charles has performed research under grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence as well. Lots to talk with him about today, including alternative energy, but first we'll get his reaction to this incredible picture. Sir Charles, how are you?
I'm doing very well, George. Thanks for having me back on the show.
My pleasure indeed. Man, you're doing some great work these days, my friend.
Well, we're staying incredibly busy. We're hoping to make a difference.
Good. Did you have a chance to analyze or look at this Spirit Rover photograph we've got up there on the website?
Yes, I did. And when I first saw it, I thought, this is astounding. And so I, with the help of a couple of friends, located the original images. And they're from, actually from fairly recent, Sol 1637. And when we were able to get the original images, I put a stereo view together so we could see if there was anything that would give us any clues about it. And so the first thing I noticed right away was the desert rock glaze
right
all over many of the rocks. And that indicates that something's been there for quite a while, hasn't moved. And the other thing is the scale of it can be told in part by the thickness of those layers, those sedimentary rocks. It's actually very small. Once we got the stereo image together, however, and you could really get a look at it, the illusion fell apart.
Oh, no.
Yes, it's actually a very thin wafer of rock. It's probably only about a centimeter thick. And there are a number of different little wafers of rocks hanging over the edge there. And so when you see it in stereo, all of a sudden it doesn't look anything like a person anymore. It looks like a postcard.
It sure looks like a little tiny Martian without that, doesn't it?
Well, it's an amazing thing. Our brains are wired to see patterns, and when we see something like that, we jump on it right away. And it's an amazing likeness. That's just like the old man of the mountain.
But
it is, in fact, simply a rock.
All right. But you have found some incredible-looking things on Mars.
Oh, amazing things. And, you know, I've spent pretty close to 4 years now doing analysis on the rover images from the moment they came back. And we found just astounding things. Very, very interesting things that look very much like fossils, and some of them I'm certain are fossils. Evidence that Mars was, in fact, an ocean-covered planet, and everything we've found so far supports that. But it's just astounding, some of the things you see that indicate the presence and action of water. And, you know, when you hear the official position on it is very, very tame, very laid back, as if they don't wish to commit. There's no doubt in my mind, and in many other people's minds, that Mars was once a water world, and there are fossils present. And, of course, on my site, I maintain a large gallery of those fossil images and water images as well.
Well, Sir Charles, it looks like, and because I've been looking at your images since you've been on the program here over the last few years, I've been looking at these images, and it looks like Mars is teeming with these fossils everywhere.
Well, you know, somebody once stated on one of the blogs that it's impossible to find an area that is that thick with fossils, and I beg to differ. If you walk on limestone or marble, you are literally walking with millions of fossils under feet. So it doesn't surprise me in the least. But there's one interesting thing that concentrates what you see on the ground, and it's called frost heave. All the spirules are on top of the soil rather than buried in the ground, and so they appear to be much richer, many more of them than there are. And the reason is water in the soil freezes, and the ice crystals force the spirals to the top. And so the fact that they're all on the surface and none underneath the soil when they dig a trench is a very good indicator that there is water in the soil, because that's the only process we know of that will do that.
Good point. Good point. Are you amazed that the rover Spirit and Opportunity continue to do what they do?
I'll tell you, the engineers on those machines were just amazing. They continue to function very well 4 years into the mission. It is really astounding.
Now, we've got another probe on the way there that we'll start analyzing once it lands, hopefully, the possibility of some kind of life on that planet. Do you think they should have done this with the rovers?
Well, yes. You know, there are constraints in how much weight you can have on a spacecraft, because it takes an incredible amount of fuel just to deliver 1 kilogram of anything to Mars. So there are great constraints on what they could put on it. What amazes me is that nowhere on the rovers are there any water detectors, nothing for a liquid or vapor or anything, and yet it's this follow-the-water mission. There are no sensors for water. That, to me, was the first thing that really stood out in my mind. You know, they're wonderful, amazing pieces of hardware, but there are some serious omissions in what they should be looking for and what they can sense.
Is it possible that there still could be some kind of small organisms buried beneath the sands of Mars in some of the permafrost?
Well, I don't doubt that at all. You know, they found salt crystals on Earth 250 million years old with bacteria in them that have been recovered and revived. So, you know, on Mars, you look at Mars and you look at the deserts where brine shrimp are found, and they come out only when it's wet, and they reproduce rapidly, and then they dry up again, sometimes for years. And it would not surprise me in the least to find many organisms still in hibernation on the surface right now.
Billions of years ago, Sir Charles, what do you think Mars looked like?
Well, you know, a couple of billion years ago, it would have looked very much like it does now, but it would have been covered with oceans, and the atmosphere would have been pretty much about one atmosphere pressure like we have here on the Earth. But because Mars' gravity is so weak, it's lost that atmosphere over the ages. So it would have probably been very much like the primitive seas on Earth, with not much more than microorganisms if it was a couple of billion years.
Might it have had vegetation?
Nothing more complex that far back than simple algae or single-celled organisms. That's about as big as it gets.
So wouldn't have trees and bushes and things like that?
No, not that far back. You see, all of the complex life we see really emerged within the last 500 million years.
Okay, so let's say 500 million years ago on Mars, would they have had that, or was it obliterated by that time?
Well, I expect that it was there, and that it just took a very long time for the environment to change. And, you know, we've been often told that Mars dried up 3 billion years ago, but that's absolutely wrong, and we know that because they found a sea of glaciers on the equator that's only 5 million years old. Well, for a sea of glaciers to form, you had to have a sea of water to freeze.
Well, that's a good point. Now, the rovers continue to operate because of solar power,
something
you've looked at quite a bit.
Well, yes. They have a special type of solar cell called the multi-junction cell on the rovers. It has three or four layers, each able to pick up a different wavelength of light and convert it to electrical power. And they're very, very efficient cells. They're very expensive, unfortunately, so they wouldn't be practical here on Earth, really.
Sometimes when they get dusty, though, they do not operate efficiently, do they?
Well, that would be true of any solar system. If you cut off your main supply of energy, which is sunlight, then it's just not going to work.
Tell me a little bit about your work that you did with robotics and artificial intelligence. You know, scientists are beginning to say now that in the not-too-distant future, Sir Charles, robots will be human-like.
Well, you know, we see two different views on it. If you have a specific job that requires something shaped like a machine, you're going to make your robots look like the machine that will do the job. If you have a job that's in the services industry or where the robots will interact with human beings, they're going to be much more human-like to make them more acceptable to us. So you're going to see two distinct classes of robots, those that do heavy industrial work that don't have to look anything like a human being.
Right.
They're going to be shaped by their function. Form and function go hand in hand.
And we've got a lot of that now, of course.
Well, that's absolutely right. We have industrial robots making automobiles and manufacturing printers and computers and canning food and doing everything right now.
But it's the artificial intelligence ones I can't wait to see.
Well, yes, everybody wants to have their own household servant.
Yeah, exactly, or driver, or whatever.
Exactly.
And it'll happen. It'll happen. Tell me about your work with alternative energy. How did this come about?
Well, a lot of my work in aerospace has provided a lot of clues to how resources that you don't normally count on can be exploited and used in a certain application. And those technologies actually have great applications here in the home and in industry. Over the last year, I became associated with a group out in New Mexico known as the World's Nest. And working with them, they had built a sustainable home. And it was an extremely inspirational experience meeting with them and seeing what they'd done. A lot of people are aware of sustainable homes such as the Earthship Technologies, and they'd taken that one better. And so I became involved with the group and decided to focus much of my research on sustainable energy and water recycling and recycled materials for construction. And so that's really kind of the springboard for what I'm doing presently. And so my work with the group in New Mexico, Taos, New Mexico, the World's Nest, ended up with the publication of a small book, and they've got that available on their website, and the World's Nest link is right there on my bio page there. And that book's for sale, and it has some material that I wrote in it that's featured and some of the things we're working on. So it explains the use of plants and architecture and your own energy generating and recycling technologies to make sustainable living something very practical and not not out of reach for the common man.
Do you ever see the day where every home will have its own power plant, basically, where we don't have to rely on the major electric company?
Absolutely,
gas company.
In fact, that's one of my goals. You see, as it stands right now, we're all vulnerable as long as we're tied to a grid. Your power arrives at the whim of some other individual.
Yes.
And if you have your own power system, you have a number of advantages. Number one, you'll never have a brownout or a blackout unless you're using so much you simply break the thing. And number two, whenever you're generating power, one of the points that seems to be missed is this. You're saving more water than if you conserved all the water in your home, sometimes 10 times as much. Because while a household may typically use about a cubic meter of water a day for, man, woman, 2.6 children, when you look at how much water it takes to generate and deliver power and industrial services to keep your home running, you'll consume from 6 to 10 times that much water and not be aware of it. So when you generate your electricity at home, you're saving an immense amount of water.
And you still can put that on the grid, can't you?
Well, yes, you can.
If it's hooked up,
something called the Public Utilities Reform Act that allows people to sell their power back to the utilities. And so many people use this as their battery. They generate power all day when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and they sell it back and it runs the meter backwards. And then the utility company sells them power at night when they don't have the generating capacity. The only hitch to that is when you buy electrical power from the utility, you're paying the retail rate. When they buy it back from you, they're generally paying the wholesale rate.
Exactly, and then they mark it up.
Right.
It's only the American way, Sir Charles. Would you, if you had your own power plant at your house, would you have to be still hooked up to the grid at all?
Well, not at all. In fact, with the group I was working with, they have a mandate that you are not allowed to be connected to the grid in any manner.
So you're all by yourself out there.
That's right. You can't have an electric hookup, you can't have a water hookup, and you can't have a sewage hookup. So all of the sustainable homes out in the that area generate all their power, and they use basically solar panels. Some of them have wind generators, and the building at the World's Nest where I was staying has its own generating capacity, and the only fuels they really use are biodiesel as their backup, and everything's sustainable. It's really an inspirational thing to see, and anybody who's going to the site can see that, the pictures of the place, and it's an amazing place. I spent many months there, and I'm just amazed. I'm going to build a place like that myself very soon.
One of the problems has always been the capacitor, the ability to store this energy and pull it back and use it whenever you want. Has that been satisfied yet? Have they come up with
there have been some amazing developments very recently, and the capacitor is one of the things they're doing some great strides in. Capacitors typically are something like a battery. They can charge and discharge very rapidly, however, and it's stored as an electrostatic charge, not as a chemical reaction. The advantages of capacitors is they can be cycled millions of times, whereas batteries generally are only good for a few thousand cycles.
Right.
Well, what they're doing now is they're making capacitors called supercapacitors that have very special materials inside that allow them to store an immense amount of electrical power. And they're combining them with batteries now. So you can get a battery that really has a combination of battery and capacitor technology built into it. And already they're using them in some hybrid vehicles. Because, as you know, a lot of hybrid vehicles have batteries inside them to store the power.
And I remember once the first time I looked under the hood of a hybrid or a fully electric car, the whole thing was battery.
Well, absolutely. In fact, the thing that comes to mind is that the National Science Agency in Australia has something they call the Ultra Battery. And it's a supercapacitor and a lead-acid battery in one unit. And what they do is they put it in hybrid vehicles, and they have a life cycle that's four times longer and produces 50% more power than a conventional battery system. Now, what's interesting is it's 70% cheaper than batteries that are normally used in these vehicles, the hybrid electric vehicles. And in a recent test, they had a vehicle that ran in an excess of 150 miles per gallon.
That's incredible.
And it did 0 to 60 in 12.5 seconds. And it was a 2007 Saturn BUE Green Line.
Oh, my goodness. I bet the oil companies didn't like that.
Well, the thing about it is, oil companies, if they know the end is near, would be best interest, it serves their interest best to invest in these technologies.
They should own it.
Well, not necessarily own it, but they should invest it and help develop it.
Right, but I don't see anything wrong with them making the batteries or anything like that.
Oh, nothing wrong with that at all. You're always going to have customers.
Exactly. Exactly. Are the batteries makeup of these storage units, are they getting smaller or are they still pretty large?
Well, many are. Here's the thing. New chemistries allow new batteries, and everyone's familiar with lithium-ion batteries.
Sure.
They're very dense and very lightweight.
We got them in our cell phones now, don't we?
Exactly, exactly. The problem is when you go for the sort of operation that a vehicle normally goes through, lead-acid batteries and some derivatives of the metal hydride batteries tend to be the best ones for the job. So, you know, battery storage is also the mainstay for anybody who has their own generating, like these sustainable homes. When you generate your sunlight power during the day or your wind power, where do you put it? Because that's not always there at night when you need it. So you end up having a battery system to store your energy. And storage is one of the biggest questions in sustainable or alternative energy. So one of the things they're pursuing is eliminating lead-acid batteries, finding other ways to do it, because if you've got these batteries, you have to maintain them.
And they're heavy. They're bulky.
They're bulky. They contain toxic materials, the lead, and they contain acids like sulfuric acid. You always have to go and check your battery water levels and your charge, and it can be a real pain. If you could find a system that got around that, you'd be ahead of the game. And the supercapacitor battery combination is the beginning of that. But one of the other technologies that isn't really mentioned is storing energy in flywheels, because flywheels can actually, on a pound-for-pound basis, store over 14 times as much energy as a lead-acid battery.
That's interesting.
So you end up with a system about the size of a small refrigerator that stores enough power to run your home for a couple of days, and it's simply stored as the energy of spin in that flywheel.
What happens if a case like that, if it's built on solar power, for example, you don't get sunlight for a week?
Well, you know, in every situation, it's always good to have either a hybrid system or a backup system or some combination of the two. Solar, as you know, goes away at night, and so you have to have a storage system. But if you have a hybrid system, you'll have more than one source of power, such as solar and wind.
I mean, like in St. Louis on very cold nights, it's going to get cold there tonight. You still need to run your furnace, for example.
Well, that's right. And part of it is in our architecture. When you build a house, you know you must insulate it. But there's more to it than insulation. In many cases, it helps to have a thermal mass. It acts as a battery for your heat that you can load up during the day, and then all night it re-radiates that heat. So insulation, thermal mass, backup generation, all of these things fit together. I think the big issue here is, for a successful system, you end up combining many technologies to make a thing that's a lot more like an organism than a machine.
All right, let's say for the average house, they spend $110 a month on electricity. The average house.
Okay.
$110 a month. So over a year, it's a little over $1,200 or so.
About $1,320.
All right. That's pretty good. How much would it cost to build one of these units we're talking about?
Well, this is one of the sore points right now. You see, if you install your own generating capacity, whether it's solar, wind, or whatever, you also have to have storage, usually, unless you're tied to the grid. And the expense of putting a system in like that means it'll usually take 15 to 20 years to pay it off.
Oh, yeah. Nobody wants to wait that long, Charles.
Nobody wants to wait that long. And here's the other thing. The real issue is most people don't live in their home more than 5 years anymore.
Good point.
So why would you put something in your home that's going to take 20 years to pay off when you're only going to be there 5 years?
Good point.
So the issues are expense, obviously, and the cost of oil at $100 a barrel helps make these systems a little more reachable. It's not very pleasant, but it does spur us. It gives us incentive to find better ways. The other thing is, the cost of the systems has typically been high enough that they only go into new home construction. It's hard to retrofit a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're building a new home, it makes a lot of sense because then it's amortized over the life of the loan.
Right.
And you don't have a utility bill.
It's built into your 15 or 30-year mortgage.
Right. And the other side of that coin is because of many of the tax credits and incentives offered by the government to go self-sustaining, you actually can defray a lot of those costs, and your loans can actually have a lower rate in many cases.
All right, stay with us, Charles. We'll be back in a moment. Charles, let's get your definition of alternative energy. What are we talking about?
Well, anything that isn't generated by the traditional use of a fossil or hydrocarbon fuel. For instance, an alternative energy would be, a wind generator. A lot of wind generators really aren't mainline right now. Alternative energy could very well be generation by wave machines where they have generators powered by the flexion when waves pass over them. It could be generated by biomass, or it could be solar photovoltaic, or just about anything that you don't normally get off of the grid from your utility company.
Good point. Why do we need to change? Why don't we just keep doing what we're doing? You know, some
because
say oil's going to last.
We're using up some of the resources we have, and we really don't know where the end is. And the cost of recovering energy right now is one of the major issues. It takes about a barrel of oil to recover four other barrels of oil. So you've got about a 25% overhead right there. And one of the things about the way we generate power that really affects our environment is that we generate about 10 trillion watts of power in the world, but we put about 15 trillion watts of heat into the environment doing that.
Right.
If you change the way you generate power, you may be able to eliminate a great deal of that heat and concentrate strictly on the usable energy end of it.
Why aren't we having leaders talking about this right now?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Why aren't we having leaders talking about this right now and really doing a job doing it? Not running around saying, there's global warming. Why aren't they trying to fix this?
Well, you know, it seems that people don't believe in a disaster until it actually strikes them, regardless of how much they know about what's coming. And even now, there's still a great deal of debate about global warming. I think one of the biggest issues in that corner is that people don't even agree on whether there is warming and what the cause of it is. But, I mean, if you look at our solar system, every planet in the solar system is warming up simultaneously. That indicates that it's really a change in the sun and not in what we're doing.
Exactly.
Although we're certainly not doing things that help.
We may be speeding things along, but I think it's a cycle.
Well, and that's true. Everything we see is cyclic. Just because the weather's been this way all our lives doesn't mean it's always been this way. Things, you know, 50, 100 years in human lifespan, that's nothing compared to the big scale of things. And I think that the real issue here is we elect the leaders we deserve. You know, we make those choices. We put them there, and we really don't know what their agendas might be or what they really are going to concentrate on. The big thing here is each and every one of us has the ability to make a change. The power isn't really so much in the hands of our leaders as it is in our own. So the simple decisions and the small things we do can, you know, collectively have a huge influence on our world. And that's what we have to concentrate on. We can't wait for somebody else to do something, like a leader. You know, we're the leaders. We have to make the decisions, and we have to take the actions.
And just do it.
Absolutely right.
How many years away do you think we are, realistically, from individual homes, for example, on a mass basis, not just all, you know, in a few spots, of being able to generate their own power needs?
Well, if you follow the traditional curve, it seems to be about a 10-year process. Hopefully the things that we are working on could bring that off in from 1 to 3 years. And, you know, I'm offering an opportunity for people to get involved in what we're doing, and I can get to that in a little bit. I think that it's really important that people have to know what their options are and that we have to stand back and take a really strong look at where we get our power from and what price we're paying and who's getting the money and what's going to happen, you know, 10, 20, 30 years down the road. We can't really just stand around and wait. And small changes can make all the difference. For instance, we consume 30% of all of our electricity in our homes, all of our energy, just heating water. And if you simply put a small solar collector for water heat on your roof, you could eliminate, you know, 10, 20, 30% of your electric bill right there.
Now that's a lot.
It is. And, you know, I calculate there's something like 12.6 trillion watts of sunlight heat falling just on the roofs of our homes. If you painted your roof white or put a reflector up there, how much of the load of air conditioning would you remove?
That's true. That's true. They've got this new aluminum paint. Is that pretty good for roofs? Or
actually,
flat
it is. It's highly reflective, and it can eliminate a great deal of the heat that normally is transferred right into your roof. So simple, very basic technology things can actually be implemented right now that could cut our consumption 20, 30, or 50% even.
We'll get into a lot of these alternatives next hour with you, Charles, and the different things that we can do. You know, here we are with this incredible urgent need to use petroleum. We just can't seem to get away from it. I happen to be one of those who believes in the peak oil theory, that there is not a peak oil, that it is plentiful on this planet. But I don't believe that dinosaurs and plants helped create this.
Well, no, there's a lot of information that states that it certainly isn't. If you look at the chemical signatures, I should actually say the isotope signatures of petroleum, a lot of it doesn't have any biological material in it of any consequence. It appears that it's actually leftover material from the formation of our planet. And there's a fellow by the name of Thomas Gold who pioneered this particular theory. And, you know, when you look at wells that have been drained out a couple of decades ago, they seem to be refilling from underneath. And much of the oil is coming from areas far deeper than any fossil can exist. And so, you know, there's probably an unlimited amount of oil. The question is, are you willing to keep burning it and loading your atmosphere with CO2, number one? And number two, are you willing to pay higher and higher costs because of the greater difficulty of extracting deeper petroleum or deeper natural gas? And on the same vein, you know, we're always worried about running out of this stuff. They just discovered something like 500 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in the northern Appalachian Plateau.
Exactly.
You know, the world consumption's a little over 100 trillion cubic feet yearly, and that's a lot of natural gas. And we tap into that, you know, we're not going to run out of that stuff anytime soon. And I hear Brazil, you know, just made a huge discovery of petroleum, and it looks like they probably have one of the largest reserves in the world right now.
See, and we all take this for granted. I mean, with our electricity, with our oil, everything, unless it's gone or there's a power outage, all of a sudden you panic. I remember last year in St. Louis in the wintertime, power was out to thousands and thousands of homes for days, not just a few hours. That's when people realize, you know what, there's something wrong here. We need something better than this.
Well, consider the following. A century ago, everybody had a sustainable home, pretty much.
That's right. You had the kerosene lamp, and you had the wood-burning stove.
So the question is, why are we not sustainable? And the answer is, it's our toys. We want technology. We want electricity. And certainly, it makes life better.
It does, but you got to pay the price.
But there is a price. And so we are now reaching the junction in our technology where we're capable of going back to what we had before, where every individual can have the security of their own and not worry about whether there is a grid or not. And I think that's a very important thing. We were just fine when we all had our sustainable homes. We had our well. We had our power. We had a windmill to pump water sometimes. And we, you know, we heated our homes with wood or whatever we had. We're not going to do things in such a primitive manner today, but we are swimming in energy. There's more energy than we know what to do with, and we simply have to be clever enough to be able to get it.
Have you ever seen a situation where people panic at a store when their computers go down in their home office?
Yes.
You're shut down. They don't know what to do.
Well, you know, 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been a problem. Everybody knew exactly what to do because there weren't any computers.
And then you had those hand calculators and this cash registers that you just push these heavy buttons, and they worked without the need of electricity. Nowadays, right. I mean, you can't do anything without it.
Well, and part of it is because of the collection of information, not the function they're performing to add the numbers up. They're trying to keep track of inventory. Everything's automated.
Everything's automated. Everything is controlled. And there is a concern, too, that, for example, you know, our entire lives will be done electronically. Big Brother will know everything about us. And I wonder how many people, Charles, really want that to happen.
Well, you know, nobody really wants it to happen, but it's not so much Big Brother as it is Little Brother. It's not the government putting these systems in place. It's the local bank, the local store, the local merchant. They want to know a little about you so they can sell you something else. And all of this information filters together to make a really big picture.
What was it, Citibank, that is putting a limit in New York on how much money people can withdraw out of their ATMs because of fraud and bank robberies and things like that?
Isn't that interesting? You know, the whole thing about eternal vigilance being the price of freedom comes to mind. And when we start giving away our freedoms for a little false security, we're really on a downhill path.
Faster than most people know it.
Oh, terribly.
Next hour, again, tell us a little bit about the various different sources and what you've been doing and how people can get involved in doing this. Can people build their own kits?
Well, in many cases, they can. And one of the things we've discovered is you can buy almost everything over the web. You can buy generators, you can buy windmills, you can buy solar panels. The real trick is, wherever you live, there's going to be a different, more reliable source of energy. You're not going to put a lot of solar panels up in, let's say, Seattle, where it rains a lot of the year.
Right. Plus, you can't put a windmill up in your subdivision.
Well, and that's right. And this is because many people consider them to be ugly or noisy,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
So there are real limits to what you're allowed to do, but a lot of people simply don't have the technical know-how. So, and I think that one of the very interesting businesses we may see in the near future is consulting firms that do nothing more than analyze your energy situation and find the best alternative systems for you.
And come out and install it for you.
That's right.
Well, that could happen. What about air conditioning?
Well, air conditioning is a very interesting thing. We eat a lot of energy doing it, but it's been discovered that you really don't need to. There's a lot that you can do. For instance, suppose you had a generator on your roof that sheltered your roof from being heated by sunlight. Well, now, originally, your roof is exposed to sunlight all day, and it's soaking it up, and it's heating the building.
Right.
If you had some sort of a generator that soaked up that sunlight for you and turned it into electrical power, not only are you getting energy, but you're also cooling your roof off. So it lowers your air conditioning bills.
Probably by 10 or 15, maybe even more.
Well, it can be quite a bit. It's like 6,000 to 8,000 kilowatts. I'm sorry, 6,000 to 8,000 watts per square meter per day, something like that. It's a huge load of heat. But keep in mind that the systems that we're building, and they're already in testing phase, we've got prototype machines ready to go, and we're doing the test right now, they will be precisely that sort of a device. It'll be something you can put on your home, puts out about 6 kilowatts of power, and it provides your electrical power, it provides hot water, and it shields your roof so you lower your cooling costs.
How long will it last before it runs out?
We're looking at a guarantee of 5 to 10 years for everything on it, and then really cheap, easy service. I shouldn't say cheap, I should say affordable, because people have the wrong connotation. Let's say low cost, very reliable. And, of course, you know, this is my hope, that everybody will be able to afford these things, and it'll take everybody pretty much off the grid.
Why can't we make it 100% tax write-off?
Well, you know, we're always looking for Big Brother to pay for things for us, and that's really the wrong tactic. Again, that's another one of those slippery slopes.
Well, not necessarily pay, Charles, but at least help us out. Make the incentive to do it.
Well, there already are incentives on solar generators, and you'd probably be able to make this fit right into that tax law.
Yeah, maybe they should be more aggressive, though.
Well, they are. You know, speaking of aggressive, I found that two countries in the world that really have the most aggressive solar power plans, are Germany, which is basically at the same latitude as Alaska, and Australia. And Australia has huge research facilities going on right now. And a lot of them are storing their energy, by the way, instead of batteries, they're using molten salt as their target, because salt takes a lot of energy to melt, and it can retain the heat for a long period of time. And so they calculate that the amount of molten salt that would fill a 5-gallon bucket would be enough to power your house overnight. The only problem is when you get into small quantities, it cools off very rapidly. So it really only works on a large scale, effectively.
That is interesting. Where are we in the pecking order in terms of countries keeping up on this technology?
I think we're down around number 12 right now, which is pretty depressing. There are a lot of countries doing a great deal more research and development. A lot is going on in Japan. A lot is going on in Australia and in Germany. Many countries, as a matter of fact, have aggressive alternative energy programs because they see the end coming. We are very insulated in this country from a lot of things that happen in the world, whether by choice or by not. We don't seem to always get the big picture. And, you know, things are a lot worse than we think they are.
Will we get these other countries, though, who are at the forefront? Will they get the technology and say, now we're going to bring it, let's say, to the United States, own it, and here it
comes?
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, I have a very interesting article that I ran across. Toshiba is building a micronuclear reactor now.
A little tiny one.
A little tiny reactor, yep. Rated at 200 kilowatts. It's only 20 by 6 feet. You can put it in a neighborhood, and it'll run for 40 years unattended. And they're charging 5 cents a kilowatt hour.
Unattended.
About half the cost of grid energy. It's completely automated, one sealed box.
Is it safe?
Well, so they say. And, you know, personally,
so they say.
As somebody who's worked with a lot of machinery, I know they can be made safe. The real problem with nuclear power at this point is twofold. Number one, human beings making the wrong choices, ignoring what the machine says. And the other one is disposal of waste.
Well, I was going to say, we've got this hang-up of people getting radioactive waste for dirty bombs.
Ah, but you see, the whole problem with waste is one of politics and not science. We've known for years how to recycle nuclear waste, but it's been basically legislated out of existence.
Well, that's another point. They just kick it out because they don't think about us for the future.
Well, here's another thing. You know, if you had a 1 gigawatt nuclear reactor, 1,000 megawatt plant, it produces about 1 cubic meter of waste a year, and that's enough to fit under just a dining room table. You know, it's not much. The greatest portion of nuclear waste being generated in this country today is actually medical waste, not power generation waste.
From all the machine, the equipment.
Well, part of it's the equipment, part of it's the glove or the syringe for the injection or the procedure, you know, the bottle that contained the tracer.
The chemical, yeah.
So a lot of it has nothing to do with power generation at all.
Huh. And where does it go, to Yucca?
That's a good question. I've seen quite a bit of it encased in concrete and not going anywhere after that.
Well, that could be a problem, too. But is there anybody out there leading the charge in this country?
I don't think I'd point to any one particular company. I've mentioned my friend Michael Fulton a number of times, and he's doing a great deal of research on solar photovoltaic panels, and he has a cell that only uses 5% as much silicon. Now, realize right now the largest point, the cost of making a solar cell is the silicon, and it's at a high price right now. It's
right.
Very hard to get pure silicon. And solar panels eat a huge amount of the stuff when you make them. So his process uses only 5% as much, and he thinks he's going to come in under $1 a watt or right at that area.
It's going to be some good investments for the future for a lot of people if they're smart.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the other thing is there's a company called NanoSolar, and they're making a coating that you basically spray on like paint, and it makes a solar cell. Now, it has to go on a specific packing material so that you can get the electrical conduction to work on the back, you know, to collect your current. But that's something that looks like it could be very useful.
Well, I was noticing on your videos you have created Fresnel lenses on plastic.
Well, that's actually something you can buy commercially, and the large lenses you see in the videos have been recovered from big-screen televisions. Anyone can find them for just a few dollars. The real concept here is taking sunlight, which is diffuse, and concentrating it to an extremely high temperature with that lens. And you can do all kinds of stuff. You can actually fire small ceramic items with it, or you can melt metal with it.
Do you ever see the big, big solar panel in space beaming it down to us?
Yes, and actually, you know, I'm an advocate of the orbital solar power concept.
Yep.
Now, what's really interesting here is that the U.S. National Security Strategy has actually been commissioning a study, and they've come up with this plan, and what they want to do is put space-based solar power or space solar power in orbit, collect the sunlight, turn it into either laser or microwave, and beam it to the ground. And they're looking at the fact that, you know, we've spent like $21 billion over the last 50 years to get magnetic confinement fusion working. And now they're saying it'll be like the year 2050 before they even get the thing going. But we've only spent $80 million on space solar power in the same period of time. Now, here's the thing. At this point, the technologies are, again, coming together. We have the technology to make this work, and the launch costs aren't really even an issue at this point, because once you get the material in orbit, once you start generating power, you have subscribers paying for it. And we could easily have orbiting power stations gather the sunlight and beam the power to the Earth. And remember the mention I made of the heat load that we generate when we make power.
Right.
Well, all that heat is off-planet. We just get the raw power. So we're not running power plants. We're eliminating the fossil fuels burned or the petroleum burned to recover oil and gas. That doesn't happen anymore. We eliminate the power converted to heat in the power plants. You don't see that anymore. You only get your electrical power in the grid where you need it, because all of the heavy work is done off planet. Now, the National Research Council basically said this is the right time for this to happen. The technologies are converging. And the National Security Space Office, the Advanced Concepts Office, basically said, this is what we've got to do. They set up an internet forum for their study, and they really got this done very, very cheaply and you know, like in no time, by talking with people on the internet, setting up a forum and gathering data, and they came to a number of conclusions. They said, you know, the first thing they have to do is to set the environment up to allow the development and to resolve some of the unknowns, and then they want to retire a major portion of the risk for business development. You know,
hold that thought, Charles. We'll
certainly
be right back with you. Well, when Sir Charles was talking about the solar panel in space, taking the laser beam, shooting it down, kind of reminded me of Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, that 1995 Steven Seagal film. Remember that one? That was an incredible. I wonder if that's possible. Well, we'll find out when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Charles. That scenario where someone turns it into a weapon—they grabs the sun and shoots the flares down, the laser beams—can that really happen?
Well, it's certainly physically possible, but if you design this as a power station, you're going to build in fail-safe mechanisms. For instance, one thing that I mentioned before was the pilot beam principle, where you have a receiver on the ground that has to be synchronized with the transmitter in order for it to broadcast. The other thing is, the density of this energy is so low that basically it wouldn't do any damage. You know, everybody has a microwave oven, and in it there's a small metal grid in front of the window. The holes in the grid are literally smaller than the waves of the microwaves, and so they can't get out and do any damage. The receiving antenna is engineered in the same manner. So it picks up the microwave energy and converts it to electrical power, and you can walk right underneath the thing and not even know. I mean, the energy density is so low that birds can fly through it, not even know.
That's amazing. Let's talk about the different forms of energy, alternative energy systems, and then we'll go through each one later. Go ahead.
Well, solar? Of course, solar is the biggest one, and it's the one that everybody recognizes most easily. And right now, the cost of solar is coming down quite a bit, and it should be easily affordable by almost anybody within the next couple of years. The new developments are things like nanomaterials that can convert sunlight into electricity using silicon or carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we go from solar, we also have to look at other methods of turning it into energy. Collecting the heat, water is very useful. Another is to heat a working material such as the molten salt they've talked about. And we have a working fluid in our system where we take the heat and we generate steam to run a tiny turbine. And that's no different than any power plant. So solar is one of your main alternatives because it's very reliable. The other one that really comes to mind is wind. Many people know about windmills. And the big problem with windmills is most of them are built to be so immense that they're really out of range cost-wise, and their efficiency isn't that good. You know, the most efficient windmill ever invented really is the farmer's windmill because it gets a lot of the wind, has a huge cross-sectional area.
Right.
And wind can be very effective. It can work day or night. So wind and sun are your two biggest ones. Hydropower is pretty common in some areas where you have large bodies of water where you can build a dam and a generator. On lower scale, you generally don't see it, but now there are many tiny turbines that can use a very low head of water pressure and actually generate usable power. So you don't have to generate a dam, the construction involved in it. You drop this little thing in the flow of water and it generates your power for you.
That's
another one is the wave machines that I mentioned. Waves can transmit a huge amount of energy from the ocean to the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And let's imagine you have a generator that, remember the old sewing machines where you had a pedal at the bottom?
Yes, the old Singers.
Right, and you stroke the pedal up and down with your foot and the thing would rotate. Well, you can build a generator that uses a flex motion similar to that, and it can actually run generators based on laying on top of the water and the waves flexing it up and down. And so you can put rafts of wave generators offshore where nobody basically goes, anywhere where it's shallow enough to have waves, and you can generate power with them.
How much power can you generate with that?
Well, actually, it can be in the megawatts very easily. I couldn't give you an exact figure because it depends on the size of the installation. But there's very low impact on the environment, basically. They don't produce any pollutants or anything. One of the things is you can put platforms like this out at sea. As long as you've got any sort of differential or wave motion, then that motion can be turned into working energy. So those are the four big ones. And then we have a number of biological solutions, such as biomass. Everybody knows what biomass is. You basically take lawn clippings or something and you convert them into a fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is another point that comes to mind right away, ethanol. A lot of people really like the concept of using ethanol, and we can make it easily.
Primarily from corn, right?
One of the problems is that they're building plants that make ethanol out of corn.
Right.
Now, this is really a very destructive idea for the following reason.
Yeah, tell me.
Now you're tying the cost of food and energy together.
Now, of course, the American Corn Growers Association will say they can make as much corn as we need for that and for the cows and people.
You see, the problem is there have already been shortages of corn in Mexico because of the cost associated with corn because it can go to make ethanol and
mm-hmm.
make more money.
And make more money. That's true.
So, you know, the cost of energy is starving people when you do that. It's much better to use, I mean, look at all the lawn clippings when they mow the sides of the roads. That's all grass, and grass can be converted to ethanol very easily. We have a huge amount of biomass that can be converted into useful fuels without having to touch our food bank.
Okay.
So this is another one of our possibilities. Russian sage is also very good to make it out of. Now, geothermal is another energy source we don't really hear a lot about because it only really works well in specific areas. Iceland, for one, has a great geothermal program, but of course they have a lot of volcanic energy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a few, I think about six different ideas for alternative energies. And there are a lot of others that are coming online in the laboratories right now and are going through testing. One of them is to actually use sound waves to generate electricity. It's called thermoacoustics. They heat a tube, it generates a noise. They have a transducer in the end, similar to a little speaker, that converts that sound into electricity.
What percent with solar, for example? How widespread is solar in the scope of all of this? 30%, 50%?
Well, at present, it's a very tiny percent. I'd be surprised if it was over 1% to 2% right now.
Wow.
But I do see that in the near term, we're going to that's going to grow immensely. I'll give you an example. If you look at the size of the Earth and the amount of sunlight falling on it, if you were to set aside a square that measured 62 miles on an edge, or about 100 kilometers square, and if you could collect all that sunlight energy and use it, it would supply all the power for the world.
For how long?
Oh,
indefinitely.
Always. Indefinitely. If you could get that much, that would be enough to power the world. Now, if you're in space, of course, the sun's on all the day, and you don't worry about nighttime. You get more out of it. But there's another method, and this is something that really strikes me very funny. Russia and China are both making a move to mine the moon, and they're doing it for a material known as helium-3. Now, helium-3 is potentially the most valuable fuel there is, and it can be used in a clean nuclear fusion reaction. It doesn't produce radioactive waste. There's an estimated 2 million tons of it on the surface of the moon, and 100 tons would be enough to supply the energy needs of the world. Now, Russia has been pursuing this for quite a while, and they expect the first phase of their program to run from 2010 to 2015, and it's going to cost them about $2 billion. And Nikolai Sevastyanov, who is the president and chief designer of Energia, the Russian rocket company, says the plan is to be done in two phases. And the first one's 2010 to 2015, and they'll have a new development of a Clipper Russian shuttle and many different spacecraft, and they're going to use the Russian part of the ISS as their staging area. And the second phase is going to run from 2015 to 2020, and it'll be about $40 billion. At the end of that, they expect to have a mine working on the moon and bringing back the helium-3.
See, innovation is going to get this done.
Well, that's right. You got to place it in the hands of private industry or people or institutions who are willing to innovate.
All right. Now, let's talk more about solar. And you're talking about these panels, and they're coming down in price. They're being more innovative. What companies are out there that are really at the forefront of this?
Well, of course, I mentioned the Nano Solar, and they're one of the ones right at the front because basically they have a new and innovative material and a simple process.
Proprietary?
Well, it is proprietary, but it's something that you essentially can print, you know, just like you can anything else, like a signboard or anything. And it turns out that even though the efficiency isn't terribly high, the cost is reasonable. And, you know, that can bring it home for you right there.
And you could constantly coat it if you had to?
Well, you could. And, you know, they're making coatings in the lab right now that hopefully, and they're a nano coating, that will be powered by UV and will automatically clean itself when there's sunlight falling on it. So that's one of the issues. You have to keep your panels clean.
Well, that's true. Now, what do you do if you get snow, for example, on them?
Oh, exactly. If you have a panel and it's snowed on, you're not going to get any power out of it. But conversely, if your panel is clean and it has snowed, you typically get more power out of it because the light snow reflects more light onto the panel. That's something that we found out that was very interesting.
Of course, we get one of these 4-foot snowfalls, we're out of luck, right?
Yes, very easily. And, you know, that's one of the problems with the system where you depend on sun that might not be there.
Is there any way around that?
Well, generally, you know, solar is going to benefit best by being in specific areas. And I'm looking at, like, states like New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California. They have perhaps the best and most reliable amount of sunlight for that sort of a project. And those are the areas that, you know, from their location standpoint, they're going to benefit the best. Other states don't have it so much. You wouldn't have it work so well in New England, for instance. And, you know, a lot of the places that can work with solar photovoltaics can also work with the concentrated sunlight methods as well. And they've got a lot of different plants that are going to be coming online very shortly. And I mentioned the molten salt. That's one of the things they're really looking into.
Yeah, and now exactly that is, they get salt, and what do they do with it?
Well, they place it in a reservoir and they heat it up, and it has to be over 500 degrees or it won't melt. But once it's a liquid, they can drive the temperature of the salt up extremely high, and it will retain the heat overnight. And basically, they have a heat exchanger running through the salt, and they flash water into steam through it and run a turbine, just like any other generator.
It's pretty innovative.
So that's one of the things they're working on. Here's a little odd thing. They're working on pressurizing air, just like an air tank, you know, off of a compressor, and storing energy in that way. And they're going to be pressurizing caverns underground so that they can store energy as pressurized air underground and then run off an air motor to generate your power.
Is that very efficient?
Well, actually, it is. It doesn't take very high technology to pressurize air. Anybody with a compressor can do it. The question is, how much of it does it take to run your house? And one of the things we're investigating is using air as your storage battery, because you can add on a number of tanks if you want, if you need more capacity. It's easy to do. And we've got a couple of things we're looking at in that forum that would be actually very useful. You can recover a lot of energy from it. The most unusual alternative energy I saw was a fellow with a hydraulic cylinder with an accumulator. He filled it with water, and he let it freeze. Well, ice expands when it freezes, and it introduced pressure into the bladder and the accumulator, and he could use it to power air motors.
Let's talk about wind power for a moment,
sure.
Charles. Down in Southern California, you see them all over the place, down by Palm Springs, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these things. How efficient are they?
Actually, not very. If you look at them, they're typically the two- or three-blade designs.
Right.
The idea with a wind generator is to capture all the wind moving through that area. Well, these two or three blades only cover like 4 to 5% of that wind area. Right away, you can see that a huge improvement in efficiency could be made. And here's the other thing. When you make very large wind generators like that, they're operating pretty much at the limits of engineering many times. The stresses on the materials are incredible. And because the tips are moving so rapidly, they can actually be a hazard. They generate a lot of noise because of the tip speed. If you have smaller turbines or smaller wind capturing devices like fans or whatever, blades, smaller ones spin at a smaller rate, a lower rate, and they don't produce as much noise if you design them properly, and they capture more of the wind. So, you know, they're wonderful. They run off of wind, and that's just free dollar bills blowing away if you don't catch it. But the expense of building and maintaining the things is terrible. They typically only have about a 40% uptime for most of the installations.
I've got a friend of mine who owns a carbon fiber company. It's a public company now. He's out of St. Louis, and they're beginning to provide a lot of material for these solar wind.
Absolutely, for the blades. They have to be very lightweight and very strong.
Yep.
Metals just won't withstand the fatigue and the stresses and their own weight.
What about the controversy, though, that you're going to kill birds?
Well, it's true. They can. And, you know, if you have a large one like that, you simply can't put a screen up there to prevent it from happening. One of the advantages to a number of smaller units is that you can put a grid or a screen over to prevent that from happening. And if one of them breaks, the rest of them are still running.
Okay. Once we get into using all these alternative energy sources, solar and wind, for example, would take up how much?
Well, actually, we could displace probably half of our power requirements on the ground with solar and wind. The only thing is, are people willing to accept the appearance that it creates? You know, a lot of people don't like windmills.
Well,
right now.
Cape Cod, for example, did they shoot that down?
Yes, they did, and it was basically on aesthetics. So the question that comes to mind is, well, do you really want power, or are you playing around? You know, what are you going to do to support your bad habits?
Oh, that's a good point. Hydropower?
Hydropower is great stuff.
It's kind of old, though, isn't it?
Most of it runs off of gravity. The sun and the wind transport water uphill. We catch it when it runs downhill. We get the energy out of it.
We're really not building any more hydro plants, though, are we?
No, we're not. And it's all because of environmental concerns, you know. It's very difficult to get a permit to build something that is going to change the geology or geography of an area or how much water is standing on it. Nobody wants to have a dam in their backyard, and nobody wants to flood areas of land anymore. And it's all basically an environmental concern. And there's nothing wrong with an environmental concern. We must be concerned about it. That's the whole thing. We don't want to wreck the planet we live on. So we have to be able to find a balance somewhere. And, you know, that's what this is all about. Not only can we generate alternative power and store it, but we have to do it in a responsible manner.
Absent from this, nuclear power plants. I didn't hear you talk too much about that.
Well, you know, I don't have a problem with nuclear power, and I don't have a problem with disposing of the materials and recycling it. I think the real thing is nobody's really pursued it in many years in this country, and it has been pursued in other countries. We've basically just kind of shut down the whole idea. Interestingly, more of the younger people coming up are taking a second look at it, and they're more open to it. So, you know, I expect to see a lot more nuclear development, and I don't have a problem with it at all. Again, I like the thought that we can get something that doesn't burn things and put stuff in the air. A lot of people don't realize that when you run a coal-fired plant, for every kilowatt of power you generate, you put roughly 10 times more radioactive material in the environment than you do from a nuclear plant, and it's because of the materials in the coal that make it through the scrubbers and the stacks.
That's one of the problems of hydrogen, right? At this point, to get hydrogen,
well, it takes a lot of other fuels to generate it.
A lot of energy.
Yeah, you know, right now hydrogen isn't an energy source. It's a battery, and a poor one. It takes about 5 megawatts of power to produce 1 megawatt of usable hydrogen with the existing technologies. Now, one of the things that comes to mind with me right now, recently there was a fellow who discovered how to burn salt water. He has an RF machine that generates like a 4 megahertz radio signal, and it splits the
water. He was looking for a cancer cure, wasn't he?
That's right, and it's funny. That's called serendipity. You look in one direction and find something totally unrelated.
Exactly.
Well, the question is, how much energy does it take to make that happen? If it turns out that it's more effective than other ways of electrolysis, you know, of splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen, if it turns out that we can get the hydrogen out of that way, then it could be a very effective means of generating hydrogen. Because right now, we burn a lot of petroleum just to make hydrogen.
Way too much.
Right. And, you know, that's the other thing about photovoltaic and wind. If you have excess generating capacity, one of the things you can do is you can create hydrogen through electrolysis and store it.
Former Chrysler Chairman Lee Iacocca has a new book out, and he is just lambasting politicians who seem to be doing nothing in any direction for Americans. And, you know, one of his gripes, of course, is energy. He said, I just can't believe it's still continuing to go the way it is. No innovation, no nothing. What's it going to take, Sir Charles, to get this really going?
You hit people in the pocketbook. You show them that it's cheaper and easier, or it's beneficial, and they want it. You make it appealing to them. Right now, the cost of oil is doing that. People are looking at alternatives because the expenses are so high. Some of the things you can do, look at a company that you like, you know, get on the web, find out who's developing this stuff, and support them. Buy stock in them. Show an interest in their company, you know, do whatever. And in fact, there's a company that is a nonprofit organization that's been supporting my work for the last few months on this generator, and they have a site where you can actually participate with them. And, you know, I'm not big into selling things, but I think that if you have a moral fiber in your body and you want to see things change, you have to find somebody to work with.
Let's talk about your generators when we come back, all right?
Okay, very good.
We will do that in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. So, Charles, let's bring people to the coasttocoastam.com website to look at the videos. The two videos you provided to us, have you explain a little bit about what they're seeing, and those people who, of course, don't have the capability of getting online, why don't you kind of paint a picture for us?
Okay. Well, there are two videos that you'll find, and one of them, incidentally, was filmed by David Sarita, who's a regular guest on your show.
Absolutely.
And it shows a little bit of the concept of what we were developing in solar concentration and power generation. And so the first video that you'll see, let me go right to that page there. I don't have it right in front of me. Mm-hmm. There we go. The first video that you'll see is the solar furnace that we set up for our test models. And we did a few experiments.
Burning brick with the sun, right?
Nothing but the sun, that's right. And we can get some incredible temperatures out of it. The image that you see is a brick being melted by sunlight. We're taking about 1.2 kilowatts and concentrating it down into about a square centimeter of area, and it's hot enough to literally make lava or boil metals. And so just to demonstrate the amount of energy you can get out of sunlight, I made this little video showing us melting a brick and explaining what some of the uses are. And so the two videos are, number one, melting the brick and showing how dense energy can be from sunlight, And the other one is, number two, showing something about the energy system that we're developing.
And both of them are very simple apparatuses.
Exceptionally simple. That, you know, that's the thing about a good idea. It's usually very simple. Anybody can understand it when they see it. And this is the power of such a very simple thing. You can put it on a medium like the Internet. Everyone can see it, and it gets people fired up right away. They know that it's something simple that they could do. And many people want to use this sort of technology because we're not burning an ounce of fuel. We're getting all of this energy simply from sunlight.
What are the applications for what we're seeing? Can those be used, or are you just doing that as an example?
Well, actually, they can be used, and there are a couple of different power plants that are using variations of lenses or mirrors to get their sunlight concentrated. We're one of those companies, and our prototype machine does, in fact, use some lenses. And so one of the things we want to do is show how simple and compact the system that generates all your electrical power can be using nothing but these lenses. Now, they automatically track the sun during the course of the day. Otherwise, they'd only work for a very short period of time. You know, the focal point of a lens would move around. So it's a very exciting and simple thing. And when you see it in operation, it's one of those, gosh, why didn't I think of that sort of things?
Well, I got to tell you, though, the use of the sun to generate the kind of power that I just saw in these two videos is absolutely staggering.
Well, it is, and a lot of people aren't aware of how much energy there is in sunlight. One of the earliest experiments I did was to take iron oxide and heat it with sunlight and blow hydrogen through it and produce molten iron. So here's a source of power for producing a small quantity of metal where you don't have any fuel.
When I saw the brick burning, I'm thinking to myself, what would happen if you put your hand under that thing?
Oh, it would incinerate it instantly.
Absolutely.
Very, very dangerous.
It's almost like a weapon all by itself, isn't it?
Well, fortunately, if you go anywhere above or below the focus, it spreads out very rapidly. So it's a very tightly contained source of heat.
How hot does that get?
We can get over 3,000 degrees easily. We've boiled steel and copper with it.
My God, with what I saw?
Yes.
That's harnessing the sun, my friend.
It's an amazing amount of power. And some of the other things we've done include experiments with the illumination using lenses. And we can actually put a skylight in your home without cutting any holes in the roof or anything using a mixture of lenses and other optics.
Why aren't the big boys getting involved right now in this, Charles? I mean, every company you've mentioned, small businesses, entrepreneurs, innovators, where are the big corporations coming in with their big dollars to get this finished?
Well, a lot of the big companies have a vested interest to protect. They've put a lot of research and money into certain products or projects, and they want to bring them to fruition. And, you know, there's typically a mindset called not invented here. So when you come across somebody who has a new idea and it doesn't fit in with their research or their goals, a lot of times it's easy to simply dismiss it rather than take a serious look at it. You know, there are a lot of backyard and garage inventors out there who have wonderful ideas, but have a very hard time cutting through all of the paperwork and bureaucracy or reaching the right people. And then again, there are 100 times as many crackpots pitching an idea. A lot of people have been burned by, you know, false hopes and ideas of this sort. So it can be a very competitive market trying to find funding for a project such as this.
Is there venture capital available?
Oh, there definitely is. You just have to know the routes to take, and it can be very tricky. I actually was demonstrating some of these devices that you see in the videos when the people who were funding my work came along, and I ended up working with them.
Another Coast guest, Dr. Stephen Greer, has been searching for the zero-point energy, the ability to do that. I'm not sure he's getting any closer.
Well, that's an interesting concept because that sort of energy seems to be built into space-time itself. It's probably not something you can harness without doing irreparable damage, if it's possible at all. It's certainly worth investigating. You never know what you'll discover along the way. But I just get a gut feeling that it's something that's not going to be useful, not in the way we expect.
Unfortunately. Well, if you had your way and you could change things immediately, what direction would you take everybody?
Well, I would definitely put orbital solar stations up because the sun's shining 24 hours a day in space.
And can that technology be done now?
Oh, it was actually capable in 1970s.
Oh,
but,
my God.
It was shot down for a number of reasons, one of which was the cost at the time. Right now, it's basically one of the reasons the Department of Defense is going after it, the reliability and the density and the fact that, you know, if you're in the battlefield and you need electrical power and, you know, energy for your vehicles and your operations, and there's no supply line to cut because it's coming out of the sky, it gives you a distinct advantage.
How big would these solar panels in space have to be?
Well, the demonstrators will actually be pretty small, probably on the scale of a couple of hundred meters or so in length. The actual generating stations will probably end up being about the size of Manhattan Island, about 24 square miles apiece, and they'll be able to produce anywhere from 60 to about 120 billion watts of power.
How many spaceships would you have to send up there for this?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's one of the things that seems to people to shut the whole concept down. The answer is actually very few. You don't send all of this material up into space. You send up factories to make it, which don't weigh as much.
Mm-hmm.
And then you set them up on the moon or a near-Earth asteroid.
It's like a little erector set, huh?
Back. That's right.
Would you, if this thing were up there at night, would you still see any kind of glow or anything from it or reflection?
It would depend on where it's located. You can imagine that a lot of them will be like very bright stars. So you'll have probably a girdle of brilliant stars around the equator at some point in our future, and every one of them would be a solar generator.
It's almost like we would create our own star system, huh?
Well, that's not too surprising, considering the way we're going. We have the capability to do almost anything we can imagine.
And a number of countries could have their own systems for their own use. You could aim them, point them wherever you want.
Yeah, you could sell power to subscribers, just like any satellite service.
And if a plane, again, flew through this beam, nothing would happen to it?
Nothing would happen to it. The thing is, though, you try to institute a no-fly zone where you have a beam coming down. And that's just good common sense. You don't fly over power reactors, and you don't fly over certain industrial facilities. You know, there are limits right now to where you can fly. You just simply follow the same course and generate a no-fly zone where you have a lot of power density.
Where would you recommend that the beam be aimed?
You know, a lot of good receiving places would be just outside of towns where, let's say, the landfills and the traditional power stations are located. A lot of it can happen in the deserts. There are some countries have actually been considering using their land to put these places up. There's a small island nation. Let me find my note here.
All right.
I wrote a note down about Palau, and they want to set up one of these rectifying antenna farms and lease that land out. Sell the power.
How much would people pay compared to normal electricity?
The targets have to be equal to or lower than what the power stations are selling their power for now. And I've heard numbers ranging from 10 cents a kilowatt down to 3 cents a kilowatt once they're in operation.
And what are we paying now conventionally?
It depends on where you go. It's usually 10 to 15 cents per kilowatt hour, if I'm not mistaken.
And you wouldn't have a weather problem, would you? You wouldn't have a problem of your down power lines or anything.
Well, actually, no, you wouldn't. You know, and that's another issue. Did you know that when you generate power and transmit it through the wires, about 30% of our electrical power is lost in transmission?
I did not know that. I know, well, it's probably buzzing down on people below, huh?
Well, a lot of it is lost as arcing. When it rains on a line, you hear a little staticky hum and a snap. It's arcing. It's going through the insulators and radiating the air
of the
ground.
Yeah, you can hear it.
Absolutely.
Would you be under that?
Not if I could help it. Certainly not during the rain.
Who are the big winners with this kind of alternative system?
Well, you know, in the long run, everybody's going to win with this because it ends up taking control of environmental pollution issues, of supply issues for power. And we're going to develop new technologies in the process. We're going to get cleaner air and a better environment out of this thing. We'll have more power than we'll ever use if we pursue this course. So we're all going to win.
So, well, again, somebody's going to be the innovator here, Charles, and this is going to take off like crazy, I think.
Well, consider if you'd had the stock in Apple in 1979, where would you be now?
Yeah, that's true.
And so the whole point is, right now, we're at the point where these systems are being built and tested. And people who invest now are going to be the ones, just like those who invested in the very beginning in Apple or Microsoft or any of the large companies, because this is going to grow just like the personal computer did. Everybody's going to have a power system.
So you're not recommending these companies like the Nano Solar?
Well, there are a number of different companies manufacturing. You know, Kyocera and Toshiba make cells, and Motec and Solartron and SunPower and Silicon Solar and NanoSolar. They're all making solar panels or solar cells of some type. And I don't pick any specific one. Each one has its own virtues. So it's all going to depend on what you need and how it's going to operate in the environment it's going to be in. you know, obviously I'm very partial to my system, and I want people to, you know, get online and see what we have to offer. And again, you know, I believe very firmly that this is going to be the new personal computer.
By the way, our friend Jerry Purnell, who's a science fiction writer and science writer, you've heard mm-hmm. of Jerry, just thinks you're doing one heck of a job right now. He just sent me an email.
Well, thank you. You know, he's always been one of my favorite authors. I've read a lot of Purnell and Niven over the years, and they're both favorites of mine. There, and I thank him for those very kind words.
There you go. He's listening intently.
Let me give you
a
site real quickly so people have an opportunity to participate in what I'm doing. Yeah, it's freewillpower.com. And go to that site.
Freewillpower.com?
Freewillpower.com. Right. And go to the site, have a look at it, and see how you could participate. And, of course, I mentioned the World's Nest, the group that I was working with there. So between the two, people can find a lot of information, and they can decide how they want to support this thing. And, you know, they may choose to support somebody else. That's great. The most important thing is this is more than a moral issue. Everybody can make a difference, and they can make money at the same time. I mean, it's raining energy, and we have to start finding a little bit of smarts, gathering it, and putting it to use.
Will different areas have different sources of alternative energy?
Absolutely, they will. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Iceland has a lot of geothermal energy available, and there are many places in the world that do. And so for them, it makes a great deal of sense to tap into that internal heat reservoir and put it to use. Of course, you know, because the conduction rate of rock is low, there's a limit to how much you can draw out. It's kind of like, you know, drawing water through a pipe. You can only draw so much through the pipe. But it is a very reliable source, and it's been there for billions of years, and I don't imagine it's going to burn out within the next couple of centuries. So that's one alternative. Another is, in many places where you're, let's say, in the Pacific on an island, you have a lot of wave energy near the shore of your island. Put it to use. Put wave generators out there. They're not going to wreck the environment. Put windmills where you've got good constant breezes, and they can be low-profile units. They can be high cross-section units. There are many things that can be done to increase the yield on the existing systems. And again, the technology has developed to the point where the costs are coming down and people are going to be putting them in not just new construction, but eventually retrofitting. So every place in the world, because its environment is different, is going to have a different source of alternative energy that's going to be prevalent for them, you know, something they can easily put to use. So you're going to see wind, you're going to see water, you're going to see solar, and everything is going to be in a different area.
Well, Sir Charles, it's sold me. We just got to get it done.
Great.
Just got to get it done. I want to take phone calls next hour with you, but let's continue chatting a little bit more about some of the work now that is done here. What will this do in terms of creating new jobs in this country?
You know, everything that you do that's an innovation creates technology and jobs. And I believe that the industry for producing energy is going to be our single most important one over the next 10 years. Because until we actually can secure common, low-cost, available alternatives, there's going to be a huge flurry of manufacturing and installation going on, and that means people will be working. And so right now, we're kind of shaking out who the new technical designers and developers are and what the new systems are going to be, but you can bet that a lot of people will be manufacturing these things. And it isn't really very difficult. I've mentioned a number of times the solar water heating panels. Those are basically stamped out of copper tubing and foil. It's been blackened chemically, so it absorbs a lot of heat. Those are very simple to produce. It's almost a cottage industry. You know, it can be done very easily. On the other hand, making it competitive is another thing. You have to find a niche in the market and build yourself in well. As far as solar generation goes, it tends to be a little more technically intensive because you've got to not only capture the energy, but you've got to actually turn it into a useful form somehow. So you've got generators and inverters and storage involved in a lot of cases. But jobs, absolutely. This will put a lot of people to work.
Which is something we have to do right now.
Well, yes, we do. And, you know, aside from all the gloom and doom we hear, and we always hear that the government's going to prop up some economic flaw or change something or other, stop messing with the system. You know, things will stabilize where they're supposed to be. The more we mess with it, the less we know about what's actually going on.
Well, that's true, too. That's true, too. Are you happy with the pace, or do you think it's way too slow?
Well, it's been a little slow, but then again, the market determines these things, and the cost of petroleum and what effort people are willing to invest are two of the major factors here. The technology really isn't as big a factor as we might think, because a lot of this technology has been around for a very long time. In many cases, it hasn't been economically feasible or technically feasible to harvest certain forms of energy. Today, we have an immense technical base, and it's growing by the second. So who knows what we're going to discover tomorrow, but you know what? We're going to be making machines to capture and use energy from now on.
Who are the winners? Who are the big winners if we convert to this kind of energy system, solar and wind?
You know, again, I feel that everybody's going to win. And solar isn't the only alternative. I think it's just one of the strongest alternatives.
It's there.
It's there. It's there all the time. And, you know, we're going to have to pursue many things simultaneously. You never put all your eggs in one basket. You have to have many alternatives. We're going to always have a use for fossil fuels, as they call them. You know, again, you and I don't believe they're fossils at all. But petroleum is too valuable to burn. It's great as a feedstock for industrial chemicals and for lubricants and plastics. Let's not burn the stuff, you know. But the winners, industry is definitely a winner, but I think the biggest winner is the individual.
I think
you
so,
regain
too.
A measure of your freedoms.
Yes, we really do. And look what it does in terms of the geopolitical scene, how it quickly and rapidly will change where we go and why we go.
Well, it's going to pull the teeth out of a lot of nations that control certain resources quickly, and I think that's going to be one of the hottest issues, dealing with the changes in the politics when you change the source of energy. Politics is all based on, you know, and in fact, even all warfare is based on two things, you know, resources and ideology.
Well, there's no question about it. Wars have been fought for economics, I think, since the beginning of time.
Sure. And there's nothing you can really do to stop that.
No.
You just have to try and make things as good as you can. And, you know, it's just within human nature. It's part of what we are. It's what kept us alive when we were coming out of the woods.
If people want to email you, how do they find you?
They can go to my website, the Xenotech Research site, or they can go to the freewillpower.com site. There are two good ways of getting in touch with me. Oh, I'm sorry. It's freewillpower.org. I was just corrected there.
.org. Okay.
.org, yes.
Yep.
.org.
Okay, very good. freewillpower.org.
Yes.
Stay with us. We'll be back. We're going to take phone calls next with Sir Charles Schultz and you on Coast to Coast AM. You're next. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Sir Charles Schultz. Your phone calls, wide open calls indeed. You ready for some calls, sir?
Absolutely.
Very good. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Good morning, George, Sir Charles.
Hi.
Good morning.
This is Ron in North Dakota, and I do have a question about storage for solar power. A couple friends and I have one solar panel, and we've been using the marine batteries for storage, one marine battery for many years, and have had real good luck. But I know the new technology coming out, there's supposed to be better storage batteries for solar. Can you help me with that?
Well, you know, it's all going to depend on the cost. There are better batteries available. I would get online and see what's on the market. That's the best place to look. Competitive shopping is your best tool there. Mm-hmm. Many people will go ahead and stick with marine batteries for a while because perhaps they won't be able to get their hands on the super batteries just yet or any of the others. But marine batteries are good. Lithium-ion batteries are good. It's all going to depend on your environment. Are you in a place where your battery might potentially freeze?
Well, I am right now, but when I take the unit out, I go to Arizona, California, Nevada, New Mexico, that area.
Okay, great. Well, and one thing that I've found is if you're in an area where your batteries might freeze, you can get a device similar to the tape that you wrap around a pipe.
Oh,
and
yes.
You can connect it right to the battery, and it's got a thermostat in it. And if it ever goes below temperature, the battery warms itself up just enough keep itself from being damaged.
Yes, we have inverters that we use, too, for 110. So we've been using it for quite a while. We really enjoy it. I really thank you for your talk tonight. I really like the show, you guys. Thanks a lot.
You are quite welcome. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Is that me?
Me?
Me, oh, here I am.
Hi, me.
My name's Jim. I'm calling from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Number one, I really appreciate your shows on the weekends. Right now I'm unemployed, so I get to enjoy you in the evenings and the mornings here. My question is this. If there is any kind of solar storms, how would that affect the power sources that you are predicting that we will have in the skies?
That's a very good question. Solar storms can produce a lot of radiation particles that can damage electronic systems. When we talk about building a system of this magnitude, we're also talking about the capability to shield it properly. So the components that are exposed the most are those that are hardened to them. Simple things like turbines and generators and that sort of stuff. When you get down to the electronics, you would always put it in a safe place, such as a shield containment somewhere. So it would be very little or no damage.
Thank you very much. And thank you, George, for all the evenings of pleasure you've given me.
You are more than welcome, my friend. Appreciate
Farewell.
It. Okay, very good. If you had to pick between these four major alternative energy sources, solar, wind, hydro, wave, which one would you pick? Solar?
I would have to go with solar because it has a lot of energy density, comparatively speaking, and it's easy to do. If solar weren't permissible for some reason, I would really look into wind power in a larger way. I would change the designs of the blades they have right now because you can up the efficiency and lower the noise right there.
All right, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hi, yes, sir.
Hi, Sir Charles.
Hello.
Hi, this is Mark. I'm calling from the high desert of Klamath Falls, Oregon.
Okay, sir.
We get some fantastic lightning storms up here in the spring. And I'd like to know about maybe putting up a lightning rod and harvesting that energy.
That's one I've heard quite often, and there are a couple of things to consider. It is possible to harvest the charge that it's in air, and you don't want to wait for lightning to do it. If you ever put up an antenna, you can notice that there's a potential difference or a charge difference between the antenna and your ground wire. That's because the atmosphere itself has a charge present in it. When the charge reaches a certain level, arcing occurs and you get lightning. If you were to build a system that could harvest the energy in lightning, you might be doing a disservice in this manner. Plant life depends on nitrates. Nitrogen is fixed by lightning bolts. It burns nitrogen and oxygen and makes the nitrate fertilizer that makes 90% of the plant life on Earth grow. If we were successful in harvesting the energy of lightning, we might do something like prevent some of that nitrate formation, and that would be bad for plant life. So it really depends on how much you harvest. It's potentially possible, but I don't think it's something that we want to do to a great degree.
How would you store it?
Well, that's the big issue. I think the big problem is transforming it into a useful form first, and then you could store it in batteries or flywheels or any other traditional storage mechanism. The great thing about electricity is it's so flexible. You can turn it into many different forms very, very easily. I would imagine some means of stepping high voltage down to low voltage. You might use stacked capacitors and electronically switch them. That's something that I've experimented with a little bit, and I think it shows promise.
Thank you. I'll look into that.
You're welcome.
Okay, first-time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Lisa from Chicago.
Hi, Lisa. How is it? Cold up there?
Very.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Very, very, and lots of snow, too.
Typical Chicago winter.
Yeah, I actually have two questions for you tonight.
All right.
What I wanted to know was, since I am in the Windy City, we're actually on the outskirts in the suburbs, but it is the Windy City out here, I was wondering about what type of power possibly could be converted out here. Secondly, my husband works for the gas company in Chicago. And I'm wondering how any of these kind of changes in the future could affect his job at work, since he's like 40 now and looking at retirement in like 15, 20 years. I'm wondering how that's going to affect us in terms of job security or any of the other people we know in like the electrical industry as well out here.
Okay. The answer to your first question about wind, you know, about 59% of the energy in a moving stream of wind can be extracted by a good turbine or windmill. The problem is you typically have to have it tall enough so that the flow isn't broken up. You see, obstacles such as trees and houses and landscape can break up the flow of the wind and introduce swirling in it, the turbulence, and that makes it less efficient. So because in many areas, particularly in residential areas, they don't allow you to put a tower of a certain height up or they don't allow windmills, it kind of becomes a moot point, but you actually could conceivably harvest a great deal of electrical power. They have a small four-foot windmill, I've often heard it referred to as a turbine, that can put out between 500 and 900 watts, depending on the speed of the wind. If you put three or four of these on a mast, well, you're talking 2 or 3 kilowatts very easily.
So, and then yes, you're also looking at codes and villages and all that sort of
exactly.
thing, too.
Exactly. You have to find some way to work
problem.
With them. And that's
okay.
the big issue right there. And as far as job security goes, you know, natural gas has been around for forever, and I don't foresee natural gas vanishing overnight. It's one of the cleanest forms of chemical energy that you can use, actually, and in many cases when they're drilling for petroleum or mining and they hit a pocket of gas, they simply vent it.
True, and isn't it abundant?
It's very, very abundant. I think I mentioned we have a new discovery of something like 500 trillion cubic feet of the stuff. And, you know, we're not going to use that up real quickly. It's going to be around for a long time. So I wouldn't worry too much about the job security as far as natural gas goes. What I would say is always have more than one vocation ready. Always be flexible. Pick a couple of things you enjoy and become good at them because you'll always be able to make a living.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
I have a question for...
Sir Charles. Yep.
I'm calling from Tampa, Florida, and about the amount of sunlight we receive, the insulation. I always see these maps that Florida isn't as good, even though it's at a lower latitude, closer to the equator than Southern California or New Mexico or Arizona. And I was wondering what should be in Florida's solar future.
Well, Florida is not that bad for solar. It's actually quite good. The real problem in Florida is humidity. If you're located anywhere in Florida, you've got ocean on both sides. And so there's a great deal of humidity, and this means a lot of clouds, and clouds interfere with your ability to collect energy. You can get quite a bit of solar energy in Florida, and when you have clear skies, it's very high quality. In fact, I spent most of my life in Florida and a great deal of time in Orlando. And a lot of our experimental work was done down there. I see that in Florida, the big future in solar will be farms that can be operated intermittently, perhaps, or more importantly, on rooftops. You see, in Florida, real estate is at a premium.
Yeah.
There are a lot of very environmentally sensitive areas. So it makes sense to place your generators and collectors in an area that's not going to affect your environment. Put them on the rooftops.
Does that help you?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're welcome.
You are welcome indeed, too. I just like the little idea of every home being able to generate its own power.
Well, it's a wonderful concept, you know, and it gives you the ability to be independent. And if you live with the grid, that's fine, and then if it goes down, you have a backup. Imagine what a difference it would have made during Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, absolutely. Next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. It's your turn. Hi there. Hello.
I'm sorry. Am I on already?
I think so.
Wow, that was fast. It was only seconds.
Well, maybe I punched up the wrong button. Let me put you back on hold.
No, don't.
No,
do that.
All right.
Hi, George. Bill Blake, your Planet of the Apes listener.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
How are you doing tonight?
Good, good.
This is a perfect show for me tonight. Very eclectic. First thing, quick take on the Mars rock.
Yes.
Okay. I think it's a hanging miniature like we use in the motion picture industry. I don't mean as no. Naturally occurring though. Naturally occurring though, because the arm is a background feature, probably 75 or 100 feet away, and you don't like coincidence, but I think by happenstance it just happens to line up with the strata of the rock there, and it's a different focus and a different density. So I think it's two elements making that picture naturally.
Okay, if you look at the 3D picture, if you get the left and right images together, you'll see that it actually is a part of the rock, but again, it's all wafer thin.
Oh, okay, and it's strata, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
Those are all sedimentary rocks.
Yeah. Well, the other part of my things tonight, I'm a recreational vehicle guy, kind of like Art Bell is, and I was wondering, Sir Charles, if you work a lot with the recreational vehicle industry, because a lot of those guys are going full-time and older people retire into them and they travel and they're putting solar and inverters on board, and that stuff's got to be very lightweight and very durable, and how you would adapt that to the home usage.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that. Some of the equipment I use has been taken from the recreational industry because it is reliable and lightweight and inexpensive, and we are targeting some of our equipment to be portable. In particular, I've got a device I've built that generates enough ozone to sterilize drinking water, and we're looking at doing something with that eventually, and I think that that's something that could be important worldwide, and it runs on like 20 watts of power. Wow.
Okay. Something like that would be ideal for use in a recreational vehicle or a campsite, because if you've got questionable water, you can do something to eliminate a lot of the organic contaminants very, very easily.
Hmm. A couple more elements real quick, too. I'll make them really fast. Did you ever reference any of the studies that Popular Mechanics did years ago, the staff there, that actually found for solar water heaters, forest green worked better than black because they were mimicking nature, the way a tree collects energy from the sun?
Well, I did read those stories, and, you know, it's interesting because the part of the spectrum that you're absorbing versus what you're reflecting is really what it comes down to. How much energy are you getting out of the incoming energy? What appears black to the human eye isn't necessarily black in the rest of the spectrum. Most of the dyes that are forest green are actually darker in the infrared band than many of the materials that we paint black to our eye. Some of them are very bright in the infrared, so it's reflecting a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not surprising at all.
Mm. Okay, final thing too, George, just a real quick story for you about Fresnel lenses.
Yes.
I did a movie years ago called Tank Girl, and the effects house I worked at, I went down and went to a surplus place and got some of the Fresnel lenses that we used as what we called zone magnifiers to magnify a map, this big plastic map in the movie. And when we shipped those out, we couldn't leave those in the loading dock. We had to take the Fresnels off the frame because if you left them out in the sun, they would burn up the consoles.
Oh,
yes.
Yep.
And these were just television magnifiers. They were actually surplus. In the old days, they used them to magnify a screen, and you kind of made a pseudo big screen TV out of them.
Yep, and remember how hot those sets used to get.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So our stuff was down at the Queen Mary Dome down there where they used to keep the Spruce Goose. That's where the Batman sets were built because we rebuilt that unit later, and we used it in Batman. And you'll also see those in the beginning of Independence Day when they pan across SETI in the very beginning of the movie.
Okay, I love it. Thanks.
I designed those.
All right, Bill, you got it.
Thanks, George.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
That's my Hollywood guy, Sir Charles, who
Absolutely.
Checks in with us every once in a while.
Fascinating stuff.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey.
I wanted to ask Sir Troll a question. A friend of mine, a number of years ago, we lived totally off the grid. I mean, we had to haul our own water. And my friend was pretty clever. We had to use solar, of course. And he designed his own wind generator using... It was an old Ford alternator, but he used a rare earth magnet. And coupled to that, it had a couple of very strong springs. So if the wind got excessive, it would flex back and reduce the speed. Does that make sense to you?
Well, actually, it does. And if you'll look at my site, if you look under the energy projects, you'll see we've done exactly that. We've taken an alternator, pulled the rotor core out, the field windings, and replaced it with rare earth magnets,
exactly
as
what he did.
Yes, it's a very good idea, and it's a very usable idea.
Yeah, it worked quite well. Also, one other question I had was, it's been some time since I've studied it, but they were, seemed to me that they were making progress in their groin cell cone to cut the wafers for the cells themselves. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, basically, there are a couple of different processes for it, and they have made a lot of progress. The traditional process is to simply pull a big boule of silicon. It's like a log, and it's like a monocrystal. It's a single big crystal. Then there's the polycrystalline process, which is a little cheaper, but it's a little less effective. And then they have the amorphous silicon, which has a very low efficiency, but it's really cheap. There are variations where they grow a silicon web in a ribbon and cut it up and make cells, and that seems to work pretty well also. What it really comes down to is how much it costs per watt, and that's the bottom line. If it's terribly inefficient but really cheap, people will buy a lot of it and make up for the difference.
All right, stick around with us. Sir Charles' website is xenotechresearch.com, and of course, he was out talking about freewillenergy.org as well. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Welcome back. Final segment now with Sir Charles Schultz. We're going to take final phone calls as well. Let's go right to them. East of the Rockies. Good morning.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Sir
Charles.
Charles.
Yeah, good morning.
That My name's Sean from Delaware.
Okay, Sean.
That magnifying, the lens experiment that you did, I actually discovered that when I was 12, all by myself with a magnifying glass, by accident. I burned myself.
Well, that's a common experience. Kids often play with lenses and magnets and things, and mm-hmm. it's amazing how much we learn from them.
Yeah.
The thing is, as we grow up and become adults, we seem to forget all those things we've learned.
Uh-huh.
It's a shame. Children are natural-born scientists.
Right. Also, you mentioned natural gas. We won't run out. What about all the methane that's beneath the surface of the oceans?
Yes, you're referring to methane clathrates.
Uh-huh.
We haven't even begun to tap into that yet. Basically, it's a means of binding methane, not chemically, but lightly, to materials such as ices.
Mm-hmm.
And clathrates have the potential of being a huge supply of methane if we ever need it. I feel that the way we're going, if we continue to develop alternative sources the way we are, we might never really need to tap into that. The only thing we have to be careful of is this. Geological changes on the ocean floor can actually release the clathrates. Some people theorize that bubbles of methane gas are one of the things that add to the mystery of the Bermuda Triangle. Ships in the area or airplanes in the area have their engines smothered, or the bubbles coming up swamp the ships, and that's why we never see any trace of wreckage, and that's what brings planes down. And they have indeed found clathrates in the area. So it's an interesting theory, and it ties together with what we know physically about it. It's a possibility.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
There you go. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
George, this is Jim, Oklahoma City. I have a question for your guest there.
Please, Jim.
Is it possible to have a magnetic engine, where if you picture the block of a regular engine, you have the crank, you have the pistons. Where the pistons are, you have powerful magnets. Above where the heads are, you have electromagnets. As the power moves through the electro, it pulls the magnets up, it turns the crank. The crank turns the generator. The generator can power the engine plus power a house or a car or whatever.
Okay, I see where you're going. And the fact is, almost every motor is a magnetic motor because electric motors use magnetic fields, for the most part, to spin. The problem here is there's always loss in every system. If you were using electric power to move your engine in the first place, some of that electrical energy is turned into heat, and it doesn't make it into the process, so there's a little loss there. And then there's friction in any motor, so some of the energy is lost in friction, which becomes heat and noise. And then you're running your generator, and no generator is 100% efficient. There's loss in your generator. So after it's all said and done, there's loss at every step of the process, and you don't end up with a free lunch. You can certainly make a motor that way that will work on electrical and magnetic fields, but it will have losses all the way around, and it won't give you anything for free.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Certainly.
There you go. Let's go next to our next wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, this is Ted, California.
Hey, Ted.
Driver.
Sure thing.
Yeah, great show, George, and hello there to you, Sir Charles.
Thank you.
My question, real quick for you, a couple of them. One is, Art has in the past talked about his broadcasting tower in the back and how it would naturally attract, I imagine, static electricity. And he says if not grounded properly, you'd go out there and it'd just knock you right on your butt.
Right.
So, in other words, it's a lot of natural standing electricity. Is there anything that we can do with volts? And then my other second question will go, anything new on Tesla technology?
Okay. The first question about the tower, there is a possibility of harvesting that small amount of charge, but the amount of power that's present isn't terribly high. It's like the shock that you get when you scuff across the rug and touch a doorknob or when you slide across a car seat. There's a great deal of voltage, and it can sting a lot, but there's not a huge amount of power to get anything done with. It would really depend on having a huge number of those antennas and then finding a way of converting that very high voltage, low current into a useful type of current. So that's the answer to that. And Art and I have talked about that a couple of times in the past. Tesla technology, it's a very broad stroke. There are many different things that Tesla worked on. He was one of the most prolific and brilliant inventors we ever had. The problem is, with every person who does things that are mysterious to the general public, there's a mystique that grows up around them, and things are misunderstood or misinterpreted, and it gets blown out of proportion. He surely did some very mysterious and strange things, but, you know, when you go back and you look at it, it all fits well within, you know, what we know of physics. nothing that's been found ever has violated the laws of physics, or we'd have to rewrite the books. Nobody is really developing Tesla technology. It's all pretty much set in stone at this point, but people are researching a lot of the things he's done. Now, one very interesting thing has come up recently. He did a number of experiments in broadcasting electrical power from one point to another, and he was successful. Recently, in a couple of the universities, they have duplicated his ability to broadcast electric power from one coil to another coil at a distance, and they've been able to do so at an efficiency approaching 60%. And they're actually working on this as a way of transmitting power wirelessly from one device to another.
Okay, good. I hope that helps. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello there.
Oh, hi, gentlemen. I happened to see on Google Video, I was just going through it, and I happened upon a water car. And apparently some people have developed these hydrogen HHO generators. You know, they did it themselves pretty much in their own workshops. And they managed to run these things off their car battery, and they can power their cars pretty much straight off of water. I wonder if Sir Charles has seen that on Google Video at all.
I haven't seen that Google Video. I've talked to a number of people who have worked on this. Think about this. If you use electrical current to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and if you just use the hydrogen, you're only getting 20% of your energy back at best. That's one of the problems with generating hydrogen. It's so energy intensive. If you put the hydrogen and oxygen both back into the cylinder, then you can recover quite a bit of energy. In most electrolysis cases, they throw the oxygen away and they don't count it. So that's one of the reasons for inefficiencies. But it's not completely the story. You can run a car off an electric battery directly and get pretty good efficiency, not great efficiency. But if you generate hydrogen with it first and then run an internal combustion engine, the engine itself is only, at the very best, 38% efficient. So there are losses all around. Whatever they're doing, there's going to be something more involved than simply hooking a battery up and getting hydrogen.
Yeah, what I saw, this guy drove his car apparently across the country, across the U.S., with about, like, I don't know, 27 gallons of water.
Yeah, and it sounds very exciting, and I would be, you know, I'd be very interested in seeing the hardware and how it operates. There have been some very interesting and anomalous things found when people research electrolysis and water and, you know, Brown's gas and this sort of thing. Very interesting things that I don't think anybody's really investigated fully. One thing I'm confident of is this. Whatever they discover, it's going to fall within what we know of physics when we figure out what's going on.
All right, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on with Sir Charles Schultz. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Todd. I love the show.
Great, Todd. Thanks.
My question relates to a discovery or an invention at RPI about last August called a paper battery. And the concept of how lightweight that is and how efficient you might think it would be to store the energy produced by these solar cells or the wind turbines, as well as its application to your space energy transfer station.
Okay, paper batteries are an interesting concept, and they work quite well because cellulose, the basic compound of paper, is at the heart of it an insulator. So some of the earliest batteries ever made in history, some of the earliest chemical batteries were made with discs of copper and zinc and paper that's been soaked in a chemical called salmoniac. And it's just basically a salt in water. So the paper was both the electrolyte holder and the insulator. So the paper battery concept isn't actually that new. The real question is it a primary or a secondary battery? Primary batteries get used up one shot and you can't recharge them, like the air aluminum battery is a good example. So if it's a secondary cell and it can be recharged, then it's going to depend next on how efficiently it charges. Some batteries can only charge at a low rate or they generate a lot of heat and destroy themselves. Some batteries can charge pretty quickly, but they lose a lot of their energy and heat, even though they don't destroy themselves. So a lot depends on what the battery is made of. As far as storage technology in the case of orbital power, on an orbital power station, you probably wouldn't be storing a lot of energy. You'd be beaming most of it to your subscribers on the ground, or you're not making any money. But there are many options for storing energy. And, you know, right now, flywheels look real attractive. Perhaps magnetic storage. There was talk about using superconductor rings. But here's an interesting twist. it was often thought that storing energy in a magnetic field in a superconductor would be a very good way to do it. We've already got lithium-ion batteries that have better density now. So that's one of those technologies that's going to kind of go by the wayside unless it's a special application for it.
And are these batteries getting smaller and smaller, Charles?
Many of them are. I've seen batteries small enough to just about fit on the head of a pin. And one of the drives for that is smaller technologies, nanotechnology, tiny robots, tiny bugging devices, tiny little transmitters and sensors. All of these things need very small power sources. And so there have been a number of extremely tiny batteries, and some of them are stamped out of paper and laminated out of a foil. So they can be extremely small.
Okay, next up, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi.
Hi. This is Don from Fairbanks, Alaska.
Hey, Don. Thanks for calling.
One of the things I found out was talking with the Phillips Petroleum Plant in Kenai, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
They had six generators that were jet turbines that had 9-foot diameters. They put out 900 degrees heat. And I asked them if they ever thought about doing a study to find out if they could recapture that and turn it into steam or electrical energy. He said they did, and they said they turned away from it because they had to worry about the Public Utilities Commission coming in and inspecting them all the time. Also, too, the micro generators that Charles was talking about earlier, the 2 meters by 20 meters, if you type in Rapid and Rapid L, the Japanese were working on those for a few years for moon exploration, colonization, and one of them could handle 250 residential units for 10 years. They work off of radioactive gas. And then there's a program called Sustainable Sweden, where Sweden went away from nuclear reactors. And I was wondering about the thermoclines of studies that they were doing off of Hawaii and thermoelectric generators.
Okay, that's a lot of stuff to talk about. Quickly, on the micronuclear reactors, they're really 6 feet by 20 feet, much smaller. They'll fit in a shipping container. And, yes, a lot of that was developed for lunar research. I was surprised to see that they'll be selling them in this country as early as next year.
Sure.
If things go as they plan. The bit about recovering the 900-degree exhaust temperature of your turbines, that actually is very doable, but one of the things you run into is you have to have a whole secondary system that you maintain on a regular basis. A lot of materials don't stand up to that sort of temperature in different environments, like huge changes in temperature, very well. And maintaining them and the cost of them can often be higher than the return in energy that you get. So it really, again, depends on your specific application. As far as the thermocline, you know, there is a lot of difference in temperature and a huge amount of energy in that all over the oceans in the world. And if you were able to put what's known as an OTEC unit or an ocean thermoelectric converter in the thermocline, you would use the difference in cold water and warm water to generate your power. And that's been done. As a matter of fact, in the 1930s, they used ammonia as the working fluid in sealed units, and they generated about 30 kilowatts of power. My feeling is if they could do that back then, we can certainly do it better today. And I do see that there are a number of companies that use a closed working fluid rather than ammonia. They often will use propane, liquefied propane, as the working fluid. So this is a technology that is making a comeback, and we do expect to see it applied in many areas very soon. And it's something that's easy enough to stamp out by the thousands. So, yes, you could use the difference in ocean temperature to generate a sizable amount of electrical power.
Charles, I got to applaud you for your knowledge in this field. I mean,
well, you really
have done a bang-up job here.
I have a good memory.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello?
Is it me, George?
Yes, sir. Take it away.
I got to tell you, your speaker tonight is absolutely riveting.
Yeah, he is. No doubt.
It's been a pleasure. Two quick questions. I know you're getting that close to the top of the hour. One, out of subservience to oil, it seems to me that we've always found a way to come up with a better mousetrap in this country. But when it comes to oil, I don't like to be a conspiracy bug, but it seems to me that there are people who have a vested interest to keep things just the way they are. And the last thing in the world they would want is reasonable, inexpensive energy alternatives. And I was wondering what Sir Charles thought about that.
Well, you know, there's one reason why petroleum has remained where it is for so long. It's hard to put that much energy in a small container. And we've had basically what looked like an unlimited supply of the stuff. And it's so easy to process and so easy to use in an engine. So
once we've set up the production for it, it was very simple to stick with it for a very long time.
So we're lazy.
It's wonderful stuff. We just have to look at the downside.
One other quick question, if I could. It's kind of a little bit off the topic, but it's technology. I had a chance to look inside the space shuttle one time, and I found it inside very primitive, very, things.
I think the word you're looking for is Spartan.
Yeah. Okay. Let's say Spartan. When you look back at when they put out the movie 2000 Upon a Space Odyssey, that was the director and writer's vision of what was to come. What the heck happened between what they thought was going to be coming down the pike and what we have now? It seems like we're not getting there.
Well, two things stood in the way. Number one, regulation made it very difficult for anybody who wanted to invest in space. And number two, there wasn't truly a great understanding of what the benefits of space travel were, what it would bring us. And so between a lack of interest because nobody saw what the immediate benefits were, and the expense was great because of the regulation, nobody invested in it. Nobody was going to invest in a system that costs billions of dollars if they don't know what the return is or if it can be turned off at the drop of a hat. Such as, let's say the government wants a transport system and you decide to build it, and then they say, oh, well, we changed our mind. And it kind of leaves you out in the cold. So a lot of space development was stopped at the beginning, whether inadvertently or intentionally, by the intervention of government. Private industry really wasn't involved in it. And if it had been, it would have been like mass production. It would have been much cheaper, and we would have it now.
What's the next big breakthrough, Charles? When do we see it?
In my energy work, I'd say within a couple of months we're going to have units ready to produce. In space travel, it's hard to say. Private industry is making huge inroads. As we know, Robert Bigelow has two space modules in orbit
now.
And, two little space stations. That's something no government has ever done
that's
before.
Freewillpower.org, correct?
Freewillpower.org. Yes, it is.
That is it. Charles, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, George. Let's do this again real soon.
Absolutely. That's Sir Charles Schulz III. For Steve Carr I, Dan Galante, Wayne Roberts, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.